and Bartlett decided, "This is a decision I made." I sat there taking it all in, not necessarily happy about Josh starting off before he had a chance to hear what I wanted to say. Then I spoke up. "I understand," I said. "You should know that I was already thinking about leaving. I've been in this position a long time. I was already thinking this July, my 3-year mark, would be a good time to leave." "Oh," Josh said. "Well, in that case, that makes this easier. I was going to tell senior staff on Monday that anyone who is thinking about leaving within the next several months should go ahead and do so. I want the team that will be here through the end of the year to be in place within the next couple of weeks. You can tell the press that is why you are leaving now. I thought tomorrow might be a good day for you to make the announcement." "Gone within 2 weeks? Make an announcement tomorrow? That isn't what I'd had in mind." My emotional response was strong and immediate. I thought to myself, he's ready to throw me to the wolves. I thought about how long I had worked for the president, about how loyal I had been to him, about how I had threw myself in front of the bus during the controversy over the Valerie Plame leak, how I sacrificed my own credibility for the sake of the administration. And now he doesn't even care to let the current storm blow over. Thanks for everything, Scott, and don't let the door hit you on the way out. Yet at the same time, my rational side understood all too well what was happening. I knew this was nothing personal. Josh was doing what he felt needed to be done, and he wanted it done quickly. I had been on the defensive too often since the Roe revelations in July. A press secretary cannot survive for long under such circumstances. Still, I wasn't going to just capitulate. I told Josh I wanted a few days to sort things through. "Early next week might be better than tomorrow," I said. Josh ended the meeting by saying that I should talk with Dan and work out when to make an announcement. It was an interesting time on the Bush administration personnel front. Some former top military commanders were calling on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld to resign or be replaced. I had been asked about this at the briefing just before Josh and I met. I strongly defended Rumsfeld, saying the president thought he was doing a very fine job during a challenging period in our nation's history. General Pete Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had also spoken out strongly in support of the secretary earlier in the day. The next morning, after reading the front page coverage in the New York Times and other papers, Josh spoke with Dan and me. He felt we needed to mount an even more vigorous defense of Rumsfeld by having the president make a statement. I thought it would be overkill to have the press pool go out to Camp David. We settled on having the president call the secretary and then issue a statement of support for him. Rumsfeld ultimately left the administration in November 2006 in the wake of major Republican losses in the midterm elections. The first time I heard the president mention the possibility of Rumsfeld leaving was in casual conversation days after I announced my own resignation. I left early that Good Friday for an Easter weekend getaway. My wife Jill and I spent the holiday at a place in Southern Virginia along the Chesapeake Bay. We talked it all over, as married couples do. Jill wasn't happy about the way she felt Josh was shoving me out the door. I understood her feelings, but having stepped back from the situation since the initial discussion, I tried to get her to take a more philosophical attitude. After all, I said, I was ready to go anyway, and while I would have preferred to do it on my own terms, a few months one way or another wouldn't make a big difference in the long run. Jill pushed back. She couldn't understand, she said, how the president could let Josh handle the situation this way after all I'd done for him. Again, I understood her feelings. Jill and I had enjoyed spending a couple of weekends at Camp David with the president and Mrs. Bush and a select few others. Like me, she'd developed tremendous affection for both of them. It was hard for me to explain that this was nothing personal. I'm sure the president and I will talk about it next week, I finally said. Let's enjoy the weekend and not worry about it. And we did enjoy the weekend, although I won't claim that thoughts about the White House and my changing situation didn't creep into my head once or twice. I connected with Dan over the weekend by phone. Jill and I were just settling into our room on the Chesapeake Bay. Dan and I agreed on the following Tuesday or Wednesday as the time for me to make my announcement. I'm sorry about how this is turning out, Dan remarked. It's okay, I assured him. I'm ready to move on. We've been through an awful lot the past few years. I could use a change. Jill's a little upset about things. She's having trouble understanding, but I'm fine. That Monday morning, in the 9 o'clock hour, the president summoned me over to the Oval. I hear you spoke with Josh last week, he began, as I sat in the chair right next to his desk. I told him I didn't think there was anyone better we could find than you. Bush went on speaking for a moment or two about how much he appreciated my service and how much he would miss me. His charm was on full display, but it was hard to know if it was sincere or just an attempt to make me feel better. But as he continued, something I had never seen before happened. Tears were streaming down both cheeks. I found myself in the funny position of consoling the president. "It's okay, sir," I said. "I'm ready to go. It's been a long ride." We visited a little while longer and had a warm embrace. As we were about to leave the office together, Bush turned to me. "I hear Jill is pretty upset," he said. "Yes, sir, she is. It's hard for her to understand, and it's not easy for me to explain to her since politics isn't her background." "She loves you very much," Bush said, "and her only concern is you. Should I call her?" I paused for a second. "I think she would appreciate that, and it might help a little. She has a lot of affection for you and Mrs. Bush." "I will call her," he said. I spoke to Jill later that afternoon. "Did the president call you?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "He and Josh both called me separately." "How was it?" I asked. "The president didn't have to do that," she said. "He was very nice and tried to help me understand. And Josh was fine." I could tell Jill was touched by the president taking the time to call. She didn't have a lot more to say about those two conversations. She was still pretty emotional about what was happening to me, and Josh Bolton, understandably, wasn't on her list of favorite people at the moment. That Wednesday, before a trip to Tuskegee, Alabama, the president and I walked out to Marine One together. But we had a stop to make first, a place on the south lawn outside the Oval where the press had been alerted to wait for a statement. It was much the same as when the president had made the announcement nearly 3 years earlier that I would be replacing Ari Fleischer as press secretary. As we walked from the office to the waiting microphone, the president told me he would try to keep from choking up. The press knew, as soon as they saw us move in their direction, that I was a dead man walking. I spoke first. "Good morning, everybody. I'm here to announce that I will be resigning as White House press secretary. Mr. President," here I had to clear my throat ever so briefly as I momentarily choked up, "it has been an extraordinary honor and privilege to have served you for more than 7 years now, the last 2 years and 9 months as your press secretary. The White House is going through a period of transition. Change can be helpful, and this is a good time and good position to help bring about change. I am ready to move on. I've been in this position a long time, and my wife and I are excited about beginning the next chapter in our life together. You have accomplished a lot over the last several years with this team, and I've been honored and grateful to be a small part of a terrific and talented team of really good people. Our relationship began back in Texas, and I look forward to continuing it, particularly when we are both back in Texas." "That's right," the president said, provoking laughter, "although I hope to get there before you." Laughter. "I have given it my all, sir, and I've given you my all, and I will continue to do so as we transition to a new press secretary over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Thank you for the opportunity." Then it was the president's turn. "First of all, I thank Scott for his service to our country. I don't know whether or not the press corps realizes this, but his is a challenging assignment dealing with you all on a regular basis, and I thought he handled his assignment with class, integrity. He really represents the best of his family, our state, and our country. It's going to be hard to replace Scott, but nevertheless, he's made the decision, and I accept it. One of these days, he and I are going to be rocking on chairs in Texas, talking about the good old days and his time as the press secretary. And I can assure you, I will feel the same way then that I feel now, that I can say to Scott, job well done." The announcement went fine, but when the president talked about us sitting in rocking chairs, I glanced at him and thought to myself, "I'm not that old, sir." I remember looking at some of the reporters' faces, the ones I'd come to know so well. They were there doing their jobs, covering yet another story in the endless round of White House news. But I also saw expressions of sympathy on a number of faces. We had developed a good relationship despite all the contentiousness and sparring during a controversial period. But they were human beings too, and it felt nice to see the look of human concern and fellow feeling on their faces. So this is what the end of the road feels like. The goodbyes, the going away parties, the kind letters and words had come and gone. 3 weeks earlier, I had announced my resignation. Now it was just me, carrying one last box of belongings, walking down the stairs to the ground floor toward West Executive Avenue, which I would drive down one last time that pleasant spring afternoon. There was only one other person present, Woody, the veteran officer of the Secret Service's Uniform Division, looking as professional as ever in his white uniform, sitting at his station, guarding the area just inside the staff entrance to the West Wing, where cabinet members are often filmed by news crews as they get out of their cars for a meeting. Woody was more to me than someone who protected the president and those of us on his team. I'd come to know him as a friend. As he turned and noticed me walking toward him, Woody rose to stand behind the arched desk. At that moment, my duties now finished, I could feel my emotions starting to get the better of me for the first time that day. It had been quite a roller coaster ride, with more twists, turns, ups and downs than any of us could have imagined back on January 20th, 2001. We had just returned earlier that day from my final trip with the president, an overnight one to Florida. "Goodbye, Woody," I said as I shook his hand and looked him in the eye. "Thank you for everything. It has been an honor." "The pleasure has been mine," Woody said. "You're a good man, Scott. Best of luck to you." "Thanks, Woody," I replied. "Take care." "You too, Scott." I would have preferred to chat a little longer, but my voice was starting to crack and my eyes were tearing up, so I turned my head and continued out the door. I didn't want to lose it in front of Woody, a good man who represented the many career men and women who keep the White House running and secure. We staff members come and go, but they remain, providing a sense of continuity and familiarity, reminding us that the White House belongs not to any president or party, but to all the people. As I got in my car, I took a deep breath. With my sunglasses in place and the tears now contained, I drove through the checkpoints, waving one final time to Woody's colleagues in the uniform division. I don't know if it was just the way they are or if the brownies Jill used to bake them made a difference, but the officers were always courteous, professional, and kind to me. It had been more than 5 years since I'd first driven into the White House complex, past those smiling, ever-vigilant faces. It had been nearly 3 years since the officer at the checkpoint to West Executive Avenue had leaned toward me and said, "You're Matrix now, you know that?" Matrix was the code name the Secret Service used for the White House press secretary. "I know," I'd said with a smile. Now I was Matrix for the very last time. The moment was emotional for me, since I had invested so much of my time at the White House. But the moment was also calmly surreal. I had an acute awareness of everything around me as I took a final look around, slowly driving through the grounds. As I exited the first checkpoint, the officer waved goodbye. At the next, I saw the officer extend a wave back to me, as if to say, "Take care of yourself," much as I'd just waved to him. Then it was past the final checkpoint, where I waved to the officer with the bomb-sniffing dog and one manning the guard post before turning to exit the White House grounds one final time. I was headed home to be with my wife, Jill, and to plan for our future together. But after more than 5 years of living inside the bubble of a presidency once filled with so much promise, and now woefully off course, little seemed completely clear to me. I was still wondering what happened. Not quite a year later, in early 2007, I would follow the Scooter Libby trial in Washington, D.C., curious to learn more about the truth. While we are never likely to know all the facts of the Valerie Plame leak episode, much had been revealed by the time Libby's trial ended. No one was able to learn more about the truth of the Valerie Plame episode than Special Counsel Patrick J. Fitzgerald and his team. They had access to all the documents and records that were available. They interviewed many people. They questioned many under oath before a grand jury. They had all the pieces of the puzzle that could be uncovered. Some of those that are still unknown are locked away by law, unlikely to be made public. Other pieces will likely never be made public by individuals like Cheney, Libby, and Rove, who have no reason to reveal them. But Fitzgerald is a highly respected, straight-shooting prosecutor. He presented the facts at the Libby trial in a straightforward manner. The case he set forth was compelling to the jury and outside observers. As a result, Libby was convicted on 4 felony counts for perjury and obstruction. The judge fined Libby $250,000 and sentenced him to 30 months in federal prison. Unfortunately, there's no way the trial could answer all the questions that Americans have been wondering about. In the next few pages, I'll give my tentative conclusions for what they're worth. Did the White House deliberately seek to blow Valerie Plame's covert status to punish her husband, Joe Wilson, for his accusations about the administration's misuse of intelligence? I don't believe it was to punish him. Rather, I believe she simply became a talking point for some in a larger campaign led by the vice president to discredit Wilson publicly and thereby diminish the effectiveness of his criticisms. The president was only generally aware of this larger campaign and authorized Cheney to use parts of the NIE to support it. When the vice president sought to find out how Wilson was selected by the CIA to go on the trip to Niger, his wife's identity and role at the agency became known. As documents disclosed by Fitzgerald with the vice president's handwriting on them show, Cheney wondered whether the trip was a junket based on nepotism that his wife helped arrange. As Cheney and Scooter Libby, his chief of staff and national security advisor, began to dig into the story, Plame's identity started to circulate among administration officials at the CIA, State Department, and vice president's office. Some have defended Libby and Rove, saying they weren't the ones who leaked Plame's identity to Novak. In fact, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage was the first to do so. But before Novak publicly disclosed Plame's identity, Libby and Rove did tell other reporters about her, and Rove became Novak's second confirming source for his article. Libby became a key player in the effort to discredit Wilson, while as Fitzgerald stated in his closing arguments, Plame's identity became just another weapon for him in the Washington political wars. As far as Libby was concerned, Fitzgerald said, "She wasn't Valerie Wilson. She wasn't a person. She was an argument, a fact to use against Joe Wilson." I think Fitzgerald was right. Did the vice president specifically direct Libby to disclose Plame's identity? I don't know. Libby's lawyers claim that Fitzgerald was seeking to suggest a cloud over the vice presidency at the trial without any evidence. But the special counsel strongly disagreed. "We didn't put that cloud there. That cloud remains because the defendant obstructed justice and lied about what happened," Fitzgerald stated. Was Bush aware of the disclosure of Plame's identity? I know of nothing to suggest he was, nor do I believe he was, based on my conversations with him at the time. In fact, his words to me indicate that he was misled by Rove, too. Fitzgerald also stated in court filings that the president was unaware of the role that Libby had in fact played in disclosing Miss Wilson's CIA employment. Did his secret authorization for Cheney to get out parts of the NIE set in motion the disclosure of Plame's identity? Possibly. It certainly encouraged the anonymous efforts to counter Wilson's accusations. Sadly, that's the way the game in Washington gets played. Was an underlying crime committed by anyone in the administration by disclosing Plame's identity? I don't know. Armitage was Robert Novak's initial source concerning Plame's identity, and prosecutors seemed to believe that it was unintentional on Armitage's part. But it's false to assert that he was the only one who disclosed Plame's identity. We now know that Libby, Rove, and Ari Fleischer also disclosed their identity to reporters before Novak reported it. Fleischer apparently did so unaware of her classified status. Rove continues to maintain that he did not leak her name and that he disclosed her identity to Cooper only to prevent him from reporting something inaccurate. Whether they committed a crime by revealing Plame's identity is something I don't know. It is in part a technical legal issue that I'm not qualified to judge. None of these men were charged with a crime for revealing her identity, but I do know that what they did was wrong and harmful to national security, regardless of whether her disclosure was detrimental to any sources or methods. Plame was a covert CIA officer at the time, and they shouldn't have been discussing this with reporters, whether it was an indictable offense or not. The vice president's office sought to find out why Wilson was sent to Niger. When his wife's name was mentioned, it started to circulate within the State Department and White House, creating a permissive environment for her identity to be disclosed. As revealed in court filings, Libby sought to enlist Ari Fleischer's help in making it known to reporters. After Novak contacted Rove, Rove went to Libby and let him know that Novak was writing about her role. Rove also disclosed her identity to Matt Cooper of Time magazine. As for what Rove and Libby told me when I was asked to publicly exonerate them, I can only conclude that they knowingly misled me. The facts have been recounted in this book, but set aside what I've written and consider another important fact. All objective observers, based on the facts that have become public, agree that what I said on their behalf was false. They were, in fact, involved in anonymously disclosing her identity, or leaking it, to some reporters. And I stated publicly at the time that my comments were based on personal assurances given to me by Carl and Scooter. I said they had assured me they were not involved in the leaking of classified information. I would never have made that statement had I known the facts. Neither man ever sought to correct the record when he could have. Instead, he let my word stand for 2 years. Rove was being too cute by half when he told CNN and later ABC News back in 2004, I did not know her name, I did not leak her name. He did not have to know Plame's name to leak her identity, as he did to Time Magazine White House correspondent Matt Cooper, and as he confirmed for Bob Novak. So both Rove and Libby deliberately allowed me to tell the public falsehoods on their behalf, a clear abuse of the White House press secretary's role. But I hold myself responsible for allowing that to happen. I should not have put myself in such a position, period. It's also clear to me that Scooter Libby was guilty of the perjury and obstruction crimes for which he was convicted. When the president commuted Libby's prison sentence, and thereby protected him from serving even one day behind bars, I was disappointed. This kind of special treatment undermines our system of justice. It's not that I wanted to see someone I once worked alongside serve time. Prison is no joke, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody I knew or cared about. And it certainly has nothing to do with personal resentment on my part. Life is too short to waste time or energy on grudges. But I believe in the rule of law, and I think a president and those who serve a president have a special obligation to live up to both the letter and the spirit of the law. President Bush certainly has the right and the power to commute Libby's sentence. But in choosing to do so, he sent an unfortunate message to America and the world that in the United States, criminal behavior on behalf of a political cause may go unpunished if those who support that cause have the power to make it happen. Those in power have access to a different system of justice. As I've explained in this book, I think it's unfortunate that the partisan, winner-take-all mentality of the permanent campaign has come to exert so much influence over the way our nation is governed. Intervening to circumvent a legally sound and morally just verdict because the defendant happens to be politically connected may be a symptom of just such a deplorable trend. And what about the 16 words controversy behind it all? Was the Bush administration guilty of a deliberate attempt to mislead the American people with the 16 words? I don't think so. I think that the researchers at the Annenberg Political Fact Check, which describes itself as a nonpartisan advocate for voters that aims to reduce the level of deception and confusion in U.S. politics, gets it about right on its acclaimed website, factcheck.org. Quote, none of the new information suggests Iraq ever nailed down a deal to buy uranium, and the Senate report makes clear that U.S. intelligence analysts have come to doubt whether Iraq was ever trying to buy the stuff. In fact, both the White House and the CIA long ago conceded that the 16 words shouldn't have been part of Bush's speech. But what he said, that Iraq sought uranium, is just what both British and U.S. intelligence were telling him at the time. So Bush may indeed have been misinformed, but that's not the same as lying. The 16 words in Bush's State of the Union address on January 28, 2003, have been offered as evidence that the president led the U.S. into war using false information intentionally. The new reports show Bush accurately stated what British intelligence was saying and that CIA analysts believed the same thing. Unquote. This doesn't mean the Bush administration was blameless in the way it handled intelligence during the run-up to war. As I've detailed in this book, the campaign mentality at times led the president and his chief advisors to spin, hide, shade, and exaggerate the truth, obscuring nuances and ignoring the caveats that should have accompanied their arguments. Rather than choosing to be forthright and candid, they chose to sell the war, and in so doing, they did a disservice to the American people and to our democracy. However, this is not the same as saying they deliberately misled and lied. Words that are emotionally charged and tend to obscure important truths and lessons in the fog of political sniping over difficult-to-prove accusations. As far as I can see, the evidence clearly supports one charge, but not the other. However, embracing the permanent campaign tactics that increasingly fuel a culture of deception in Washington is just as problematic in its own way. I don't believe the path to better democracy is served by exaggerated claims, distorted partisan attacks, or unsupported accusations of bad faith. Neither of our leading political parties is a repository of evil, and the vast majority of leaders on both sides of the aisle and at all levels of government are decent, well-meaning, and hard-working citizens who love our country and want to do the right thing. In diagnosing the problems we suffer from and the kinds of changes we need to make, I think it's crucial to cling to the truth, even when it is more nuanced, complex, and ambiguous than extreme partisans on either side may choose to believe. Chapter 17. Changing the Culture of Deception. When George W. Bush arrived at the White House, I believed he offered a real opportunity to move beyond the hyperpartisanship and excessive politicking that have come to characterize Washington. But it was not to be. The permanent campaign approach we publicly denounced and distanced ourselves from in the 2000 campaign was vigorously embraced after Election Day. The massive Bush campaign machine was integrally woven into his White House governance without adequate controls or corresponding checks and balances. Ultimately, that machine worked not only to spin the media and defeat our opponents, but to spin and defeat ourselves. Imitation, they say, is the sincerest form of flattery. If so, members of the Clinton administration should feel deeply flattered when they look at the Bush administration. In our own way, we built on the art form the Clinton White House established and took it to a higher level. It worked well in a number of ways for Bush, as it had for Clinton. Bush was able to pass historic education reform, reduce taxes, implement important new measures to strengthen homeland security, including some that were controversial, give all seniors prescription drug coverage under Medicare, expand trade, and mount unprecedented efforts to combat debilitating disease in Africa, all in addition to notable successes in the war on terror abroad. You may agree with some of these policies and disagree with others, but there's no denying that Bush's presidency has been enormously consequential. Its influence on the course of history is still unfolding and will continue to do so for years to come. In this sense, Bush is a president who achieved a tremendous political impact, for good or ill. It's another demonstration of the short-term power of the permanent campaign. But if President Bush and his team had recognized and understood the many pitfalls of the permanent campaign approach to governance, the administration as well as the nation would have been better served. Our excessive embrace of the permanent campaign philosophy had the greatest consequences for the presidency of George W. Bush when it came to Iraq. No single decision caused the wheels to come off the Bush White House, but the way we went about executing the decision to go to war, from making the case to the public, to inadequately planning and preparing for its aftermath as we rushed into it, sent us badly off track. Selling war through a political marketing campaign, rather than openly and forthrightly discussing the possible need for war with the American people, is fraught with danger. Today we are seeing its destructive results play out. Washington is as polarized as ever, and Congress and the White House remain unable to come together for the good of the nation and our troops to forge a consensus way forward and bring the Iraq War to an acceptable, successful conclusion. The president is seen as once seemingly untouchable credibility. His honesty and trustworthiness plummet, leaving questions of deliberate deception lingering in the public discourse. I still like and admire George W. Bush. I consider him a fundamentally decent person, and I do not believe he or his White House deliberately or consciously sought to deceive the American people. But he and his advisors confused the propaganda campaign with the high level of candor and honesty so fundamentally needed to build and then sustain public support during a time of war. Had a high level of openness and forthrightness been embraced from the outset of his administration, I believe President Bush's public standing would be stronger today. His approval ratings have remained at historic lows for so long because both qualities have been lacking to this day. In this regard, he was terribly ill-served by his top advisors, especially those involved directly in national security. All the president can do today is hope that his vision of Iraq will ultimately come true, putting the Middle East on a new path and vindicating his decision to go to war. I would welcome such a development as good for America, good for Iraq, and good for the world. Bush knows that posterity has a way of rewarding success over candor and honesty, but as history moves to render its judgment in the coming years and decades, we can't gloss over the hard truths this book has sought to address and the lessons we can learn from understanding them better. Allowing the permanent campaign culture to remain in control may not take us into another unnecessary war, but it will continue to limit the opportunity for careful deliberation, bipartisan compromise, and meaningful solutions to the major problems all Americans want to see solved. I've tried to avoid becoming embroiled in the question of who started the partisan warfare and who is most responsible for the current culture of deception in Washington. It would take an entire book even to attempt to answer the question. My guess is that an objective, nonpartisan look at the facts would conclude that there is plenty of blame and responsibility to share, from presidents of both parties, to Democratic and Republican leaders of Congress, from partisan pundits and interest group leaders, to the complicit enablers in the Washington and national media. Let the one who is without sin cast the first stone. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to find anyone who has lived in this destructive world of Washington, a world that has grown detached from the problems and priorities the American people care most about, who is truly without sin. This is the reason so many Americans, especially those in the broad majority at the center, feel disenchanted and even disgusted with politics. And this is why we urgently need to get beyond blame and recrimination and focus instead on cleaning up the system. The good news is that a desire to see that happen is real and growing across the country. Is it possible to divorce campaigning from governing? Should it be a crime to try to manipulate the sources of public approval for governing as the permanent campaign requires? I don't think so. That would be a dangerous road to travel. Our political leaders must be aware of popular opinion, and to govern effectively, they need to appeal for the citizens' support. In this sense, campaigning and governing do go hand in hand, and pretending otherwise would be folly. Fraud and deliberate deception, of course, are another matter. So is the misuse of government offices and funds for purely partisan purposes. These are crimes, and they should be. If there is hard evidence of anyone in government crossing the line of legality, then he or she must be held to account. But to try to define the modus operandi of establishment Washington as inherently scandalous misses the mark and allows the root problems to continue unabated. Unfortunately, elected leaders of both parties are having it both ways. They condemn the permanent campaign rhetorically, even as they embrace its most destructive and inherently deceptive tactics. The excesses of the permanent campaign need to be addressed and ended. They are deeply destructive to our national political discourse, and the consequences are all too real in terms of both policy and politics. To criticize the system is not to excuse or absolve elected leaders of either party for the decisions, tactics, and means they have embraced that contribute to the destructive excesses of the permanent campaign. The vast majority are good people, but they were elected to lead, unite, compromise, and put our nation's best interest above that of their party. Too few have stepped forward to lead us beyond the partisan excesses. President Bush is paying a heavy price for his failure to do so. His public standing has been severely diminished as a result. But simply pointing the finger at one person obscures the bigger problems that need addressing and correcting. Our elected leaders must begin the process of change by ending their inside-the-box mindset of doing what everyone else does. They are in the best position to alter the status quo, and no one can do more than the president. No one has as loud a microphone or as prominent a stage as the president, and the primary responsibility for initiating change rests with him or her. Note, for the rest of this chapter, I'll refer to the leaders of tomorrow simply as he, to avoid the awkwardness of saying he or she repeatedly. No disrespect is intended to any current or future national leaders of the female gender. End note. The president could exercise an immediate positive impact on the culture in Washington by taking some key steps that do not require an act of Congress. Not that these steps would be easy to accomplish and sustain. they require constant awareness of the excesses of the permanent campaign, of the long-term dangers of engaging in politics as war, and of the need to deprive the scandal culture of its lifeblood, including internal inaction, secretiveness, stonewalling, obfuscation, and dissembling. Presidential candidates could start by informing themselves about the perils of the permanent campaign, not just in terms of current political tactics, but in the broader context of American history and its evolution over generations. Reading The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, the book edited by Norman J. Ornstein and Thomas E. Mann that I referenced in an earlier chapter, would enlighten many. Seeking wise counsel on how to deal with the problems of the permanent campaign from scholars who have studied it should be an early step as well. As I witnessed with President Bush, it is not enough to preach unity and pledge to change the tone. Most Americans are ready for both, but rhetoric is meaningless without concrete steps. What institutional changes would a potential president make to counter and minimize the damaging aspects of the permanent campaign? In what ways would the potential president make bipartisan deliberation and compromise central to governing, something that is constantly and integrally embraced? It will not be an easy task to overcome the excesses of the permanent campaign. A president must have a specific plan that can reassure the public his commitment to reform amounts to more than empty words. A president-elect should insist that those overseeing his transition into office learn about the permanent campaign, what it is, how it works, and the consequences of embracing it. A president-elect should also insist that his senior staff heed the same lessons. This could enable new administrations to avoid some of the pitfalls the Bush administration fell into, such as taking a massive campaign apparatus into the governing structure of the White House, a particularly dangerous mistake when there is no strong counterbalancing force in place. Once in office, the president must demonstrate an unyielding commitment to three important principles. 1. A high level of openness, forthrightness, and honesty when communicating with the American people. 2. A spirit of inclusiveness and unity which reaches across partisan divisions and ideological differences to encourage cooperation among all groups and individuals. And 3. A readiness to consistently govern toward the center, seeking common ground from which to solve problems rather than appealing to a narrow base of opinion. Most people, I think, would applaud these principles in the abstract, but how can they be practiced in concrete terms? There are a number of good ideas in the public domain already. Here are some to consider as well that do not require a lengthy implementation period or an act of Congress. I'd recommend a significant change in the White House senior staff structure. I have thought about this based on my own experience, as well as through examining the structure of the White Houses that preceded the one I served. First, the president should appoint a deputy chief of staff for governing. This position would be responsible for making sure the president is continually and consistently committed to a high level of openness and forthrightness and transcending partisanship to achieve unity. Organizationally, this deputy would report directly to the president and the chief of staff. The policy directors, personnel director, senior political advisor, communications advisor, and White House counsel would be under his and the chief of staff's authority and direction. With such authority and responsibility, this person would also need some top talent working in his immediate office. He would likely need three dedicated assistants, each with important, specific responsibilities. 1. An assistant to focus on unity, integrally involved in the legislative policy and political apparatuses. He would work to make sure that legislative policy and political priorities are set with an eye towards substantive engagement with leaders from the opposing party and the search for common ground. For example, when the details of a new healthcare program are being developed, he would ensure not only that legislators of both parties are consulted early and continually, but also that representatives of interest groups on all sides of this issue would have a chance to contribute to the conversation. Doctors and nurses organizations, insurance companies, for-profit and not-for-profit healthcare companies, patients' rights associations, labor unions, employer groups, and many others. 2. An assistant to focus on transparency, integrally involved in the presidential papers and document processes, as well as responding to requests from citizens groups and interest groups for information about the policymaking process within the White House. This transparency assistant might also oversee a potential reform of the process for classifying intelligence information and other government data, making sure that the secrecy needed to protect vital security interests isn't abused as a way of protecting an administration from revelations that are merely embarrassing or politically inconvenient. 3. An assistant to focus on tone, integrally involved in the White House communication structure, including dealing with all high-profile controversies that invariably arise in the executive branch. His job would include making sure that the messages the administration chooses to deliver reflect respect for the leaders of the other party and for the legitimate concerns and needs of all Americans. This assistant would have the responsibility for identifying and halting unsavory political tactics that foster needless division in Washington and among social, ethnic, religious, or geographic communities. The Deputy Chief of Staff for Governing will need to be an experienced statesman who is knowledgeable, skillful, and respected enough to work across party lines. He should have a deep understanding and appreciation for the permanent campaign and its potential consequences, as well as a deep appreciation for alternative ways of governing via deliberation, consensus, compromise, and cooperation. A strong presence or force of personality is also important. He must be someone who, when necessary, can look the president or his highest-ranking advisors in the eye and say, "With respect, you're wrong." The Deputy Chief of Staff for Governing would be critical to keeping the permanent campaign in check and making sure the senior political advisor or team of advisors does not exercise inordinate influence over events inside the White House. This is an important concession to realism. I think it's unrealistic to hope that a president's top political advisors will not have a significant influence in the White House. The goal should be to balance political considerations with non-political ones. Creating a new position that focuses on governing is one way of achieving such balance. The Deputy Chief of Staff for Governing would need to have full knowledge of what is going on inside the administration in order to fulfill his important role. He would need to be included in every senior-level policy, legislative, personnel, communications, and decision-making meeting regarding both foreign and domestic issues. He would need to be provided with all relevant documents and information, and he would need to have full access to the president. Whereas the chief of staff might act as an honest broker, above and outside of the intramural battles that inevitably arise in any administration, a role that Andy Card filled, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governing would be a strong advocate for his designated priorities. If he did his job well, he would probably butt heads with the president's political advisors from time to time. In fact, if he rarely or never engaged in such conflict, it's almost certain that he would not be doing his job as I've envisioned it. A Deputy Chief of Staff for Governance could do a lot to help the president move our country toward a style of leadership that is transparent, inclusive, and candid. Qualities that I believe Americans are longing for and will readily embrace when they see them. Let me address each of these a bit more fully. First, transparency. In our age of 24/7 news coverage and instantaneous communication, it defies logic to think that an administration can be successful without embracing transparency. The information age increasingly demands openness and forthrightness. No person or entity can control public opinion in a world with such a wide array of sources of public approval, from blogs to citizen journalists to growing advocacy journalism on the right and left, and the diverse sources of news and opinion and ways to get them, especially on the internet. All of these trends are healthy for democracy, for ensuring accountability and getting to the truth. Embracing secrecy beyond the necessary classified national security information is a recipe for disaster in such an environment, where what a White House tries to keep secret invariably comes to light. It is far better to be open and forthright about it than to let suspicion grow or allow others to determine the storyline. Just as important, embracing openness and forthrightness leads to positive change and internal accountability. In an open government, problems cannot be brushed under the rug. Transparency encourages corrective action, including holding people to account when needed. As a leadership characteristic, inclusiveness means making sure that deliberation and compromise with Congress is as much a focus as campaigning to manipulate sources of public approval. a president must constantly reach out to members of Congress and engage in good faith deliberation and compromise to enact legislation and solve pressing priority problems, and the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governance would be charged with promoting and facilitating these efforts. Promoting inclusive leadership also means continually exposing the president to outside experts, scholars, and elder statesmen of all points of view for advice and counsel, particularly on the most consequential or controversial matters. And it means making sure that the president's governing team is significantly more transpartisan than it has been in recent history, including a healthy number of members from the other party and possibly an independent leader or two. Such transpartisanship would be particularly important in today's hyperpartisan, ideologically driven Washington environment. The president's cabinet should be the place to start. It's not enough for a president to name one or two members of the opposing party to minor cabinet posts, as President Bush named Democrat Norman Y. Mineta to the relatively obscure post of Transportation Secretary. Why not a Secretary of State, Defense, or Treasury from the opposition party? It's easy to think of distinguished, capable, centrist figures from both the Democratic and Republican parties who are admirably suited to fill these roles. What a powerful gesture of national unity this would be coming from our next president. It is also wise to have a cabinet that reflects the ethnic, racial, religious, geographic, and gender diversity of America. This is a goal that President Bush did an admirable job of pursuing. This can easily be achieved while reaching out across party lines to assemble the presidential team and without sacrificing the paramount qualities of intellect, experience, training, judgment, and integrity. The need for inclusiveness also means actively reaching out to leaders of various constituencies, both those who are naturally supportive of the administration and those who are not. The president serves all the people, and the White House should reflect that. The next Democratic president should make a point of spending time with such traditionally conservative groups as evangelical Christians, gun owners, pro-life activists, and tax cut advocates, while the next Republican should reach out to gay rights groups, teachers' unions, animal rights lobbyists, and environmentalists, to name a few. Even if no one's opinions are changed, some common ground may be discovered on which positive change can be built. And in any case, to show mutual respect and a simple willingness to listen would do much to reduce the toxicity that pervades the Washington atmosphere. Inclusiveness also means constantly monitoring presidential and White House communications to ensure a tone that rises above partisan politics and minimizes or eliminates the use of scorched earth politics, both internally and externally among key support organizations, including the national party apparatus. There is nothing wrong with message discipline. It is useful and necessary in today's media environment, but it needs to be kept within the context of a high level of candor, honesty, and respect for the opposition. By the same token, campaigning to engage the public behind policy initiatives is also vital, but not at the expense of deliberation and compromise. Citizen groups, industry organizations, nonprofits, and activist associations shouldn't be regarded primarily as weapons to be deployed in partisan warfare, but rather as partners who can help solve problems through mutual exploration of opportunities and options. Emphasizing candor can help to ensure that the inevitable controversies that arise with every administration do not harden into a permanent state of suspicion and warfare. If the Deputy Chief of Staff does his job, the president will not allow a controversy to turn into an outside investigation or legal proceeding without at least making an honest effort at resolving the problem internally. When scandals arise, as they will, the president must demand thorough investigations and necessary remedial action, including disclosure of the facts and holding people accountable, even if this costs the administration the services of talented subordinates. In today's partisan climate, we sometimes hear loyalty described as a paramount political virtue. Presidents demand loyalty from their advisors and staff. They demonstrate their own loyalty in return by shielding them from accountability. This kind of loyalty often does a disservice to the American people. Public servants must remember that they take an oath to the Constitution of the United States. Our first loyalty is to the nation and its people. When conflicts arise, loyalty to the nation must take precedence over party loyalty or personal loyalty. If this means blowing the whistle on misdeeds or insisting that wrongdoing in office be fully and firmly punished, so be it. A readiness to adhere to this rule is essential for any presidency that seeks to transcend the corrupting atmosphere of today's politics. A president committed to the core principles I've outlined and a White House structured to make sure he is following through on them could do a lot to set the right tone and discourage the practice of scorched earth politics in Washington. But other players of the political game also have important roles. Congress could help us move beyond partisan warfare and the culture of deception. Today, members are too consumed with raising money, appeasing special interest, and outmaneuvering the opposition to win the next election. All elements of the permanent campaign. A lot of good ideas have been proposed for changing the system in Congress. They are worth pursuing, but leadership can make a change in tone and attitudes happen now. Unfortunately, leaders of both parties are trending away from statesmanship and toward partisanship. It is these leaders, the Speaker, and the majority and minority leaders in the Senate and House, who must take the initiative. The national media can help change our political culture as well. There's much they do right, but it is often overshadowed by what they do wrong. Network news has been losing viewers in recent times. There are many reasons, including the proliferation of news sources, many now tailored towards specific audience interests. But one important reason, I believe, is that the networks are stuck in the past. Their national news desks remain focused on covering the horse race of the permanent campaign, not only during election years, but continually, emphasizing controversy and talking about who's winning and losing in Washington, rather than really digging into the big issues Americans care about: the economy, healthcare, education, crime, war, and peace. To break out of their slow ratings decline and their creative rut, the news media need to learn to think in new ways. The American public hungers for truth, not just as it relates to petty partisan squabbles and the controversy of the day, but larger truth, including the hard truths we too rarely hear emphasized on television or see written prominently about in our major newspapers and magazines. The network that can find a way to shift from excessively emphasizing controversy, the conventional horse race, and image-driven coverage to give a greater emphasis to who is right and who is wrong, who is telling the truth and who is not, and the larger truths about our society and our world might achieve some amazing results in our fast-changing media environment. I'll bet I'm not the only viewer who would be energized by programming like this. The political drama is entertaining for me, as it is for most politicos, but Americans would be better served and more responsive to news that focuses more on the larger truth. There are more mundane changes in media practices that could also make a big difference in our political culture. During electoral campaigns, reporters should work harder to pin the candidates down on policy specifics rather than accepting generalities and rhetorical flair. Newspapers and TV news programs should monitor the number of column inches and the amount of airtime they dedicate to horse race stories about polls, campaign tactics, and strategies as compared to policy substance. They should set specific targets for each kind of coverage so that sports-style coverage of the political game doesn't overwhelm what citizens need to know to make informed choices. Media outlets should devote more resources to fact-checking ideas and information provided by political campaigns, politicians in office, or special interest organizations. When a candidate bends the truth, reporters shouldn't hesitate to point that out. When a television commercial uses emotional appeals, distorted imagery, or misleadingly selective facts to promote a particular point of view, news organizations should expose those tactics, even if it means braving the fury of an offended advertiser. There are a number of organizations showing the way towards such improved media coverage. I've earlier cited the Annenberg Political Fact Check as an example of a nonpartisan group that is trying to improve the level of honesty in our political discourse. We need more organizations like this one. We also need to encourage the media to fulfill their vital role as advocates of honesty, transparency, and mutual respect among our political leaders, and there are encouraging signs that this is happening. Truth tests of campaign ads have become a normal part of political coverage in many newspapers, and CNN's Keeping Them Honest reports bring a similar fact-check approach to cable news. Now the media need to institutionalize this kind of coverage and make it a central focus of their political reporting. The media, too, sometimes needs help in staying honest. I'm happy to see that an increasing number of news organizations are employing ombudsmen to act as advocates for fairness and ethical standards. These ombudsmen investigate charges of bias, monitor newsroom practices, and criticize unfair or shoddy reporting whenever they find it. In a way, they play a role vis-a-vis the media, not unlike the role I advocate for a deputy chief of staff for governing, serving as a kind of institutional conscience. This is a beneficial trend, and I hope it continues and spreads. I hope that my friends in the media, including the solid professionals in the White House press corps I greatly enjoyed working with, will respond positively to the critique I've offered in this book. I know most reporters enter journalism with high ideals. I believe many of them agree with me that it's time for a rededication to those ideals, for the good of our nation. Finally, there is a role for every citizen to play in changing the tone of our political system. We need all Americans to be involved in shaping the national conversation and in advocating, even demanding, that our political leaders respond to the real needs of the people. As I write these pages, it's exciting to see the enormous new outpouring of interest in the 2008 presidential campaign among millions of Americans, including many centrists in both parties, independents, and individuals from groups that once showed relatively low rates of political involvement, young people, and racial and religious minorities. I hope this trend continues and spreads in the years to come. With the right leadership from the president to Congress to the media, I believe it can. New technologies already play a part in encouraging greater activism among ordinary citizens. The internet provides a platform for millions of people to share their thoughts, opinions, observations, and reporting about local, national, and world affairs, giving voices to many who once had none. Social networking sites make it easy for citizens to form groups based around specific interests, from support of a particular candidate to concerns ranging from foreign policy to the environment. At times, the messages disseminated via blogs may be shrill and uncivil, and the videos popularized by YouTube may be vulgar or silly, but the fact that more people than ever feel able to express themselves and their opinions is a very good thing. And in time, it should force political leaders to be more responsive to the will of an aroused and informed citizenry. Most important, we as citizens can help change the tone of the national conversation by making an effort to reach across lines of party, ideology, and background within our own communities. Find ways to be involved. Join your local library board, PTA, or civic association, and learn to communicate with people whose worldview and environment may differ from yours. Listen to the concerns of neighbors who may vote for a different candidate than the one you favor, worship at a different church, synagogue, or temple than the one you attend, or none at all, and earn their living in a way you may never have considered. You may find you have more in common than you assume, and if we can find ways to work together constructively at the grassroots, maybe a little of the same spirit can filter its way up to the halls of Congress and the White House as well. The Bush administration will soon recede into history. Future historians will debate the long-term consequences of the fateful decisions made by President Bush and his chief advisors for years to come. But I hope all Americans will participate in the conversation about what we can learn in regard to the right and wrong ways to govern from the last 8 years of our shared history. It can be difficult, even painful, to look back on our own mistakes. It's tempting to focus on the obvious triumphs or ignore history altogether in our constant quest for a better tomorrow. But I'm convinced there's much to be gained from thoughtful, candid, and probing self-examination, and that requires an honest look at what happened. Acknowledgements. I owe special thanks to the team at Public Affairs, especially founder and editor-at-large Peter Osnos, and Marketing Director and Senior Editor Lisa Kaufman. Their commitment, support, and insights were invaluable. Lisa's editorial suggestions and questions were of tremendous benefit. Robert Kimsey and his production staff did excellent work, as did Chrisona Schmidt on the copy editing. Publisher Susan Weinberg and Publicity Director Whitney Peeling helped address the publishing and publicity challenges. Carl Weber has my deepest appreciation. His editorial ideas, suggestions, and exceptional work kept this project moving forward and helped make sure it was completed in a timely manner. He delivered more than could have been expected, and I am grateful for his help. Mimi Bardaji provided some helpful research. I thank her for her great work and quick turnaround. Craig Wiley, my literary agent and founder of the Craig Wiley Agency, helped me navigate the book publishing world. If not for Craig, I would never have been matched with such an outstanding group of people at Public Affairs. He has my deep appreciation. I had the honor of serving alongside many good people at the White House, none more so than those who worked in the office of the press secretary during my tenure. For all of my shortcomings and missteps, they did so much right. The credit for all the good we did belongs to them. I'm forever grateful to Claire Buchan, Sean McCormick, Trent Duffy, Dana Perino, and Fred Jones. I also thank Kate Starr and Mike Anton. Carmen Ingwell and Tina Hervey did a wonderful job serving as my special assistants. Nathan Carlton, Joel Kilday, David Scherzer, and Brian Bravo stayed on top of the breaking news and did outstanding research work. Assistant Press Secretaries Pam Stevens, Aaron Healy, Ashley Snee, Adam Levine, Reed Dickens, and Josh Deckard did a terrific job. I appreciate Lois Cassano's great work and assistance. Special thanks go to all the staff assistants. Amanda Devuano, Georgia Godfrey, Peter Watkins, John Roberts, Rachel Sunbarger, Will Holly, Teresa Pagliolca, Harry Wolfe, Carlton Carroll, Greg Williams, and Liz Donnan. I have also been blessed with a wonderful family. As always, they were there to support me from beginning to end during the writing of this book. I especially thank my mother, Carol Keaton Strayhorn. Most importantly, I thank my wife, Jill, for her love, advice, comfort, and guidance throughout the course of my time as press secretary and during the writing of this book. I cannot imagine getting through it all without her. This concludes the reading of What Happened, Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception by Scott McClellan. Copyright 2008 by Scott McClellan. This book was read by Scott McClellan. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Public Affairs, a member of the Perseus Book Group, and was produced in 2008 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.